This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Italian politician comes out as Rome burns over world pride. Ellen's stand-up politics energized the Millennium March. And gay poet Mark Doty probes his youth in a new prose memoir. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending June 3rd, 2000. Italy's Minister of Agriculture, Alfonso Pecoraro Scanio, this week identified himself as bisexual in an interview with the weekly news magazine Panorama. He's believed to be Italy's first cabinet minister ever to openly identify himself as other than heterosexual, and Panorama captioned his photo, "Courageous." When the interviewer asked him directly if he is gay, he said, "I'm against choosing just homosexuality or heterosexuality. Me, I choose absolute sexual liberty. I think a one-way choice is self-restrictive." A member of the Green Party, Pecoraro Scanio will continue to keep opposition to genetically modified food at the top of his agenda, noting that sexuality is important, but it isn't the central thing in my life. Italy's only openly gay member of parliament, communist Nicky Vendola, praised Pecoraro Scanio and said, "A double morality is in force in our country, in which some things can be done, but they can't be talked about. I think a lot of colleagues are afraid to come out of the darkness."
Pecoraro Scanio made his announcement at a time when the July celebration of World Pride 2000 in Rome is being hotly debated. The Vatican and right-wing groups maintain that it's offensive to the Church for gays and lesbians to celebrate Pride in the Holy City in the Jubilee year, even though World Pride was planned before the Pope declared the Jubilee year. Pecoraro Scanio said, "It's a normal demonstration against discrimination, and in Italy, both the right to demonstrate and the right to choose one's own sexual orientation exist. I don't see where the offense to religion is. The Church is trying to portray gay pride as some sort of sex show."
But the continuing opposition to World Pride seems to have worn down Rome's mayor, Francesco Rutelli. After months of staunch support for Pride, this week he turned against it. He was ready to withdraw the city's substantial grant to the celebration. The city council overruled him, but he's now limiting financial support to specific events rather than the entire 10-day festival. He also required Pride to remove the city's logo from all its materials, indicating withdrawal of sponsorship. But the city council called on Rutelli to ensure that permits were provided for all of World Pride's scheduled events, while last week the Minister of the Interior had wanted them all moved out of central Rome for security reasons. Gay and lesbian activists demonstrated outside Italian embassies and consulates in a number of cities this week, demanding that World Pride be allowed to proceed.
A former longtime Australian cabinet member who once filed lawsuits against those who said he was gay, this week owned up to his long-standing relationship with another man in an interview with the Herald Sun. Dr. Neil Blewett first met his partner, Robert Brain, when they were university students nearly 50 years ago. They were lovers then, but after serving the military together, they separated. Blewett went on to have a 26-year heterosexual marriage and two children, but after his wife died in 1988, Brain moved in with him and his son. Rumors began to circulate, and at the time, Blewett vigorously denied them, saying they were a smear campaign by doctors who disagreed with his policies on AIDS and other health issues. He sued two doctors and a radio station, and one of the doctors actually paid him damages. 5 years later, Blewett was posted to London as Australia's High Commissioner to Britain, and there Brain was described as helping out in the kitchen when Blewett entertained. Since Blewett's retirement, he and Brain have lived quietly in Australia's Blue Mountains. Brain is an ethnographer, writer, and needlework artist.
The powerful Australian Medical Association this week elected open lesbian Dr. Karen Phelps to serve as its president. It was something of an upset because Phelps was running against the AMA's sitting vice president, and the group has always previously picked someone from its national executive. Phelps has been serving as the AMA's New South Wales president. She's best known as health editor on a daily television show and a columnist for the Australian Women's Weekly. She's also board chair of Satellite Group Limited, the world's first gay-identified company to go public. She was outed by a tabloid in 1998 after celebrating a commitment ceremony with her partner, Jackie Stricker, a former teacher who now serves as Phelps' personal assistant. Phelps maintains a general practice in Sydney.
An Israeli lesbian couple also celebrated a victory this week as Israel's highest court made them the nation's first legally recognized same-gender parents. Nicole and Rudy Berner Kadish both hold dual Israeli-U.S. citizenship, and although they met in Israel and intend to live there permanently, they've both been studying in the U.S. Rudy bore their son Matan by artificial insemination in California, where Nicole legally adopted him. But Israel's Ministry of the Interior did not want to recognize Nicole's parental status on the grounds that a child could not have two mothers. Two of the three judges on the High Court of Justice disagreed and maintained that foreign adoptions should be recognized. This would seem to open the door to gay and lesbian couples leaving the country to obtain second parent adoptions they cannot get in Israel. Already, heterosexual partners who cannot marry in Israel because one is Jewish and the other is not routinely go to nearby Cyprus for marriages, which are then recognized on their return.
Zimbabwe's Supreme Court this week rejected the final appeal of the nation's first post-colonial president, Kanan Banana, who was convicted of 11 counts of sexual harassment and sexual assaults against 9 men. Banana's attorney had asked the court to strike down Zimbabwe's sodomy law as a violation of privacy. Although the justices were divided on that issue, a majority believed the law should stand in recognition of prevailing social attitudes. Banana's was no test case for consensual acts, since most of his convictions were for actions he committed during his 1980s presidency against lower-level staff serving under him. The court described him as using his immense superiority of status to beat down the resistance of his young victims. Banana's sentence was upheld by the court, and unless his longtime political colleague, the notoriously homophobic President Robert Mugabe, pardons him, he will have to serve at least 1 year in prison. Banana, now 64 years old, is a married father of four, and before his trial, he was a distinguished international diplomat in Africa, an ordained minister, and head of the theology department at the University of Zimbabwe. He has always denied all the charges against him and denies that he is gay.
But Massachusetts State Senator Cheryl Jacques is gay, she wrote this week in an op-ed piece in the Boston Globe. The four-term Democratic senator from Needham was defending the state's continued funding of its pioneering Safer Schools programs for lesbian, transgender, and questioning youth. Those programs have come under a concerted attack from a parents group that claims they are pursuing a gay agenda in the schools instead of preventing suicide and anti-gay harassment. But public safety issues, particularly those involving children, are a top priority for Jacques, a former criminal prosecutor. The previous week, she had successfully defended the school's program's funding in the state Senate, and in her op-ed piece, she was making her case to the public as well. She included the statement, "As a gay person myself, I understand in a very personal way the tremendous pressure these young people feel." She said later, "If I were writing a column about anti-Semitism and I were Jewish, I would point that out."
School programs continue to be the hot issue in Scotland, where the government is working to repeal Section 28. That Thatcher-era statute prohibits local governments from devoting resources to the promotion of homosexuality and bars the teaching of same-gender couples as pretend family relationships. According to surveys, it has also inhibited educators from intervening in anti-gay harassment in schools. But among the vocal opponents of repeal is Brian Suter, until recently the richest man in Scotland. And this week he announced the results of the mail-in poll of Scottish voters that he and his allies paid at least £1 million for. Well over 1.2 million Scots returned ballots opposing repeal. Almost everyone who supported repeal did not participate in the unofficial poll, and the return was a modest 32%. Suter has taken the results as a mandate to spend the next 3 years using his millions to defeat politicians who support repeal as they seek election to both the British and Scottish parliaments. Despite the threat, the Scottish Parliament continues to move toward repeal.
And finally, Bill Clinton was the first U.S. president ever to issue a proclamation of June as Gay and Lesbian Pride Month, and this week he did so for the last time. He took the occasion to renew his calls for enactment of federal anti-discrimination and hate crimes laws to protect gays and lesbians. He wrote that, "Gay and lesbian Americans have made important and lasting contributions to our nation in every field of endeavor. Too often, however, gays and lesbians face prejudice and discrimination. Too many have to hide or deny their sexual orientation in order to keep their jobs or to live safely in their communities. This June, recognizing the joys and sorrows that the gay and lesbian movement has witnessed and the work that remains to be done, we observe Gay and Lesbian Pride Month and celebrate the progress we have made in creating a society more inclusive and accepting of gays and lesbians. I encourage all Americans to observe this month with appropriate programs, ceremonies, and activities that celebrate our diversity and recognize the gay and lesbian Americans whose many and varied contributions have enriched our national life."
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 3rd, 2000. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
Coming up later in the program, an acclaimed gay poet talks about his latest prose offering. But first, as throngs of people poured into the Capitol Mall in Washington, D.C., the rally site for the April 30th Millennium March for Equality, none of the honored guests was more popular backstage than the world's outest comedian, Ellen DeGeneres. Excited fans congregated behind security fences, waiting for a glimpse of DeGeneres and her partner, actress Anne Heche, and waved, snapped pictures, and squealed with glee whenever the couple appeared outside the VIP tent. From the stage, DeGeneres told the crowd the many reasons it was such a special day for her and how she hoped it would make a difference for the future.
Hey, everybody. First of all, I want to mention this, how wild this is for me, first of all, to be here, and what a privilege this is for me to be here, because I wasn't out for the last march, and I sat at home and watched it on TV and cried because I was not a part of a family that I knew I belonged to. And I know that there are a lot of people at home watching feeling the same way, because you can justify it any way you want to justify it, why you're not out, but it's because you're ashamed of yourself and you've let society beat you down so much that you believe them. But the wild thing for me is that this march is happening 3 years to the day of the airing of the coming out episode. Thank you, Disney. We love you for that, Disney. I love you too. I think the thing is, and you also, yes. All right, and you. And then that's it. All right, I love all of you. I think we're kind of preaching to the choir here. We're all sending out these powerful messages, and we all feel the same way. People wonder why this is important to have a march like this and to have a celebration. And it's because when you grow up being bombarded with messages, subconsciously or just as blatant as they can possibly be, that there is something wrong with you simply for being gay or for whatever reason, for the color of your skin, if you're bombarded with that, it's hard enough as a human being to have self-respect. It's hard enough to deal with the fear of rejection and approval, and it gets worse and worse and worse as you get older. But it's compounded when you're gay and when you're raised with that for so many years. We need a day like this to overcompensate as much as we possibly can. We need this love and support. Anybody can relate to going to school, going to high school or grammar school, and just being tortured by the school bully. And as a gay person, we are bullied by society every single day of our lives. And it hurts. It hurts so, so bad that sometimes you feel like it's safer to just stay in the closet and live your life and be safe. But there are children out there that are being tortured and killed because we're not visible enough. And I know, as a celebrity, the most important thing I'll ever do is to stand up and make a difference for those children who need voices to speak for them. We owe that to them. And I would beg anyone, any celebrity, to please come out. It is the most important thing you'll ever do to save lives. So, I do feel proud that I'm gay. I feel very proud that I'm gay because I feel like I'm on a special spiritual journey that most people don't get to experience. If you're not a minority, you don't have a struggle and you don't have a purpose to your life. You're just going along with whatever your daily routine is. But when you're gay and when you're fighting for something, or you're a person of color and you're fighting for something, your life takes on such a meaning. And there's such a bond that we all have with each other because of that struggle. And that's why we cheer each other, and that's why the parades are necessary, and that's why we need to walk away from this day and spread this. We can't just have this day and you go back to your jobs. People think this is a political thing. It is a political thing. It's still legal to fire people in 38 states just because they're gay. This is political. This is who we are. We are human beings who are being treated as second-class citizens, and we can't do that. We just can't. We see so much hate around us, from Dr. Laura to you know, anybody, the picketers. When you see that kind of hate, it is just a blatant absence of love. That's what hate is. It's an absence of love. And it's hard because I feel like I see those picketers and I think, you know, if I were a loving, nonviolent, spiritual person, I would really go over there and grab those signs and smash them over their heads and shove them up their asses. Loving spiritual person. I think they give Christians a bad name. It's just sad and pathetic, and it's a one little family, and we should give them a hug or something. Poor little people. Poor little sad people. Driving back in their van. We showed them. I have enjoyed being here. This is a once in a lifetime a moment for me, and last night was amazing. I thank you all for your support and your love. Go out there and do that for everyone else in the world so they can see who we are. Be positive role models. Do all the things we're supposed to do. Just show that we're good people, that we're not crazy freaks. All right, show them that we're crazy freaks.
That was Ellen DeGeneres speaking at the rally following the Millennium March on Washington.
There's a whole new generation growing up around us now. They depend upon us for the guidance we hand down. With pure hearts full of wonder and trusting open eyes. They're the real reason to leave a little light behind. Leave a little light behind. Spread a little love around. Plant a little seed of hope for someone who needs it now. If you are in England, go on and shine, shine, shine. But remember when you go, to leave a little light. You don't have to be a big star, to leave a little light.
I'm Stephen Fry. The great Oscar Wilde once said, "The only sin is stupidity." That is why it is imperative that we stay as informed as possible. An excellent way to do this is to listen to This Way Out, the international radio program for all our sexually diverse communities.
Gay poet Mark Doty's work has been praised for its passion, elegance, and empathy, and has brought him numerous awards, including the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Witter Beiner Prize for Poetry, as well as grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Guggenheim Foundation. In 1996, Doty published his first memoir, Heaven's Coast, which describes his 6-year descent into grief as his longtime partner succumbed to AIDS. His latest book is another memoir, one that covers a very different phase of his life, which he discusses with This Way Out's Steve Pride.
Let's talk a little bit about your book. Firebird explores your early years, so let's talk first about those years. What forces contributed to you becoming a poet? I mean, when it's career day and everyone's saying, I'm going to be a fireman or a cowboy, very few kids go, poet.
Right. Well, I didn't either. I learned early on to join my little life to the larger life of music or of books or of paintings. This book is called Firebird because I had a wonderful teacher in fourth grade who used to ask us to push all our desks back against the walls in the classroom, and then she would put on Stravinsky very loud, and she would say, now children, move. And I loved that. I loved that feeling of freedom and exhilaration and stepping out of the limits, as it were, of my own body. So that kind of experience became a touchstone for me, and I knew what I wanted to do was make something, but I had no idea what, really, until I was in high school. And like many kids, maybe especially many kids who experience a lot of turmoil, it was very important to me to keep a notebook, a journal. And it wasn't a diary at all. I was never any good at writing down what happened to me every day, which just seemed dull. This was a kind of journal of the inner life. There were bits and pieces of images, phrases, daydreams, not at all about what happened to me at school or at home, because I didn't want to think about those things, but rather what happened to me on a much more interior level. And I gradually began to take those things and start to shape the phrases and images into poems. I became interested in poems for two reasons. I was reading them. I was reading Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, and I loved entering into the world of those books, and I loved the little songs the characters sang. And I thought I could take these images and phrases in my notebook and I could make something like that. I also stumbled across the poems of the great Spanish modernist Federico Garcia Lorca, which are poems that are saturated in color and feeling, poems that are songs, deeply lyrical. They're also poems that are in some way untranslatable. You can translate them from Spanish into English, but you can't translate them from poetry into prose. You can't paraphrase exactly what those poems are saying, and yet they speak very immediately and directly to the life of feeling. So I started to make little poems, and one day my high school drama teacher asked us to perform something that we had written. That was our assignment: write something, bring it from home, perform it for the class. And when I had done that, she said, no, it's supposed to be something you've written. But I said, I did. She didn't believe me, and she asked to see more. And then she took the poems and showed them to an acquaintance of hers who was a poet, Richard Shelton, who lived in my town, Tucson, Arizona, which is where I went to high school. And an amazing thing happened. Richard Shelton called me up, asked me to come see him, and started meeting with me once a month or so. I was about 15 at the time. And he would look at my baby poems and kindly, you know, make very few criticisms, but tell me what he liked and give me suggestions about what to read. Now, that in itself was influential, but the really amazing thing was just seeing somebody who said, I am a poet. That's what I do. I'd never seen anyone who claimed that identity. The idea that a person could organize his life around these beautiful, elusive pieces of language, that they could matter so much as to be at the center of a life, was thrilling to me. And I think from that time on, poetry was what I did. I didn't believe I would make a living from it. And I suppose I actually still don't make a living from it. Very few poets do. I teach at the University of Houston. I give readings. I do short-term workshops for other poets, all kinds of things to sort of patch together an income. But poetry is, I think, will always be the touchstone for me. It's the thing that I can't lose, because if I didn't write poetry, I don't think I would know who I am.
Well, the new book, Firebird, is your second book of non-poetry, although I would argue that it's very poetic.
Right.
Your first was Heaven's Coast, which was about your partner and the period following his death.
When my partner Wally died, we had been together for a dozen years, and I desperately needed to give some kind of shape to what I felt in the aftermath of his death, but I could not write poems. Why not? Well, I suppose it was because my life, as I had expected it to be and as I had known it, had broken. It had cracked. And I felt like my form had broken, too. If I was going to speak about this at all, I had to speak about it in some other way. I also felt that poetry was too tight, each word so carefully chosen, and each word needed to bear so much weight. And this awful, unbounded sea of grief was not going to fit into that contained form. Well, when I had finished that, and then, you know, done lots of work to edit the book and to shape it further, I went back to writing poetry. I had already begun to write poems again during the writing of Heaven's Coast. But what I missed was this sense of the larger arena. There's a way in which when you write a poem, you're always taking things out. You're always deciding what you can excise, because poetry is about the most compressed gesture you can possibly make, the most intense gesture, in order to say what it is you need to communicate. Now, prose, of course, is selective, too, and a good piece of prose is as tightly organized, every bit is as necessary as the bits of a poem. But when you're writing it, it feels like another kind of thing. It feels like, at least for me, I have permission to put things in. So it seemed the perfect form for writing about childhood.
In Alexandria, you wrote, "If endlessness offered itself to me today, I don't think I would have done anything differently." Still true?
What a good question. True at moments, yes. Yes, true at moments like the one that poem describes, which are characterized by that feeling of full-heartedness, of being fully present.
For This Way Out, this is Steve Pride.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Brian Nunes, Graham Underhill, Jason Lynn, Chris Ambage, Martin Rice, Rex Walkner, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to Alan Wiley and Planet Out. Jess Hawk Oakenstar sang Leave a Little Light Behind, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by grants from the Gill Foundation, the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, and by Query.com at www.queery.com, by Planet Out, from designated contributions by Uncommon Clout Visa card holders who've chosen This Way Out, and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. For audio cassette information or with any questions or comments about This Way Out, please email us at tworadio@aol.com, visit our webpage at thiswayout.org, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. And do be sure to include the call letters of this station. Remember, you can also hear This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on Multimedia, then on Radio. For Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks to you for listening on KEUL Girdwood, Alaska, WRPI Troy, New York, 4CCR Cairns, Queensland, and more than 100 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. We're sure that you're going to stay tuned.